Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 233, Daughters of Nalanda.
In a great year, we're coming to the end of this. We're in the 12th month, in the way the Tibetan calendar operates, of the pig year, earth pig, I think it was. Yeah, it was earth pig. And a tough year for His Holiness. Thank goodness it's almost over, because he is a pig year person. And so this is also the 600th year anniversary of Tsongkhapa's parinirvana, as I've told everyone, or his communion attainment, Yogananda attainment of a Mahasiddha Buddhahood, where a minute he died, technically, which in Buddhist science is when the clear light, super subtle awareness mind with its super subtle energy body that arises from the heart center separates itself from your subtle nervous system, not super subtle, but subtle nervous system, which is your spine, your central channel, right and left channels, and then your sense organs and your coarse body. And it separates from that. And it could separate from that while hovering within it, which is what happens to the Siddha Yogi. So then they leave the body in a kind of state of trance and return to it after they do something with the subtle body projection. But death technically is when it is at that point of separation. And at the instant that that happened, Tsongkhapa's vow of celibacy as a monk ran out, and he was then able to embrace, you know, in a way, his female side fully, and then enter communion as a male-female. Two people in one, but still as a real female and a real male, very complicated, and there are a lot of complications involved in that. But they would say he took on what is called a jnana mudra, an intuition consort, which is like an angel being. And this being is already in a subtle body, not in a coarse body. And so he manifested back in magic body instead of the bardo, and he went with a subtle body consort. And then with that, he was able to attain, because he was so primed to do so, the rapid stages of the fourth stage of the perfection stage and reached the fifth stages, the stage of communion, both the learner's communion and the master's communion, the two levels. And it's even that there's still progressivity even in the communion stage. And everybody witnessed amazing visions around his coarse body corpse at that time, you know. And because they did, they then mummified it, and it was preserved for 500 years, almost 500 years, until more than 500 years, actually, from 1419, in a sort of sarcophagus type place thing, in a stupa, a beautiful stupa, in Ganden Monastery, until 1966, when it was torn apart and the mummy was thrown to be torn up by dogs, by the communists in Tibet in 1966. Very, very sad situation. So anyway, so now we're coming to the Iron Mouse year, which is the beginning of a new 12-year cycle, and I'm not so much know what that is. But anyway, during the year, I had a lot of, but not as much as I would have liked, exposure to some of the deeper levels of genius of the great Tsongkhapa, Losang Dakpa. I always think of his initial, I like to say his actual name in Tibetan was Losang Dakpa, which in English transliteration, the first syllables are LSD, even though the way Tibetan is, it's more complicated. But I don't know why. That's just my past, my unsavory past. And when I say the advanced reaches of it, he, you know, his sort of great tantric teachings, even though he couldn't reach some of those stages where you have to be, have a mother and a father, you have to get to your mother's side as well as your father's side. And he couldn't do that as a monk because of the vow of celibacy. And he didn't do it as a monk for 21 years, from 1398 to 1419, because he wanted to stay a monk, because most of his contemporaries needed the monastic vocation to be able to focus their energies on learning and evolutionary development, accelerated evolutionary development of the path and toward Buddhahood. And if he had done it at the age of 41, then many younger people would have said, oh, yeah, I'm going to be a tantric yogi now, and they wouldn't have had the learning needed and the understanding needed to be able to really do it, and they would have, it would have ended up with a lot of out-of-control people. So he withheld his own progress in one way, and in another way, he progressed enormously in his writing. Now, in that, I have to pay again tribute, as I have in previous podcasts, and I must urge everyone to read Thubten Jinpa. Dr. Geshe Thubten Jinpa, he has a life of Tsongkhapa in a series of Shambhala publications, giving lives of eminent great masters and teachers in the past. And it's a marvelous work. It's showing in detail how Tsongkhapa developed, who he studied with, what he, how he taught, and what he thought. Really, really marvelous book. I mean, I can't sing its praises highly enough. I could quibble about a few things, as scholars always do, but really nothing compared to the massive achievement that it is. Really heroic and brilliant, actually. So I recommend everyone do that. That helped me a lot this year. That came out this year. We had a conference about it. And then second, he pointed me to some readings that encouraged me in what I'm doing about these tantras, because of Tsongkhapa being the foremost commentator on those tantras, and Tsongkhapa and his close disciples, because some of the things he did verbally and they wrote down. And it's really amazing. It's really amazing. It's like I'm beginning to get the whiff, let's say, of the psychological neuroscience. And I mean, that's real psychological, you know. Psychology comes from the word psyche, which means the mind and spirit. And it doesn't mean the brain. But modern Western psychology, because of the dogma of materialism, thinks it's just study of the brain. And they don't even read Freud, much less Buddhist psychology, or even ancient Western monastic psychology, which is very profound also. St. Bernard, you know, St. Francis, these kind of great people. So, you know, Bonaventure, you know, Thomas A. Kempis, you know, Imitatio Christi, you know, the amazing things, you know, John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, Hildegard of Bingen. These are great psychologists, these great monastic enlightened beings, Western ones. So anyway, I really have had a glimpse of how sophisticated and definitely neuroscientific. And then this brings me to this one topic that maybe is the main topic for today, which is Buddhist science. I have a student who once blithely informed me in a conference. He doesn't hang out with me now and then, so I don't see him much, but so he's been, we have, our conversations are glancing like that. And also I'm bad. I don't go to enough conferences and things as an elder. But he says, oh, by the way, Bob, I hate to tell you, but there's no such thing as Buddhist science. And I said, really? How did you discover that suddenly? He said, oh, well, no theory revision, he said. I said, really? And then he ran off, and I didn't have a chance. It wasn't because I didn't have a chance to debate it. And this is, but I understand what he meant, and I can, and that's the latest argument. Of course, the main argument is that there can't be pre-modern science, because a lot of the pre-modern sciences are considering the mind to be part of nature. even though it doesn't have mass. It's not material in the sense of, if you think material means having mass. Now, in modern physical science, there is this ambiguity where mass is separate from energy. And so energy by itself doesn't have mass, and yet they interact. And that doesn't seem to be a problem to materialist dogma of materialist scientists, although I think it makes them uneasy. And therefore, they went absolutely berserk a couple of years ago when they claimed to have discovered the secret of mass, which was the Higgs boson, as they called it. And there was a very triumphal bunch of articles and announcements and prizes handed out and all kinds of things. Even though there was always the, you know, conditions on that discovery that, well, but then there's dark matter and dark energy that our inferences have to be fitted with, and we haven't seen them yet. And also, we didn't directly catch a Higgs boson and have it in a glass here to show you. We just have the statistical results of all kinds of experiments and explosions of other particles and whatever. So, you know, it's hedged. It's actually a very hedged discovery. But still, energy without mass, E equals mc squared, is like Einstein, like the greatest thing. And so energy and mass are different, right? So why can't mind and mass be different, or mind and matter be different, and still matter, mind be studied? So that's why pre-modern, so-called pre-modern, is really pre-materialist science. Now, Buddhist science, so just to get back to my opponent's argument. So, and also second thing is that Buddhists in particular claim, uniquely, I think, that Buddha attained omniscience. That is to say that Buddha is defined as a person who knows everything. But then what that means is also complicated and analyzed in a complicated manner. And, you can call someone omnivorous, and you don't mean that they have everything in their mouth and stomach in the entire universe and they already ate it all. It just means they're ready to eat whatever they look at. Omnivorous would mean, you know. And we use it even when we know someone doesn't eat dirt. You know, they don't eat rocks, you know. I mean, maybe little ones. They can't digest them anyway. So, point is, you know, you even omni, the prefix omni, which means all. So omniscient can have complicated thing. But that's the idea. And so the idea is he's the perfectly fulfilled scientist, in other words. He actually came up with an understanding of how reality works. He completely understood it. Unified, you could call it a unified theory. The problem is, and so then, so they assume that if you claim that, that there's no theory of revision, because they assume that whatever you say is going to be the final theory, because they themselves are ideologues. The materialists are ideologists, and they think there is one theory out there that's going to explain everything. And they think that some people claim right now, I just bumped into a quantum high-energy particle physics guy who claimed to have unified the fields that Einstein failed to do, but Einstein claimed he was going to. And I don't know, I can't, you know, and it's all explained in mathematics, it claims. And I have to try to evaluate it, and I've let my mathematical genius slip for about 50 years. So that'll be hard for me. But that's what they think. Therefore, if Buddha knows everything, then he would make one theory and that'd be the end of it. Except for this one problem that he didn't think of, my student, my debater rather, my colleague, I should call him at this point. He didn't think of one thing, which is Buddha's theory is that there is no theory. How about that? Therefore, all theories are revisable, including all of Buddha's theories, except that one. Because all that one means is that any one theory is only valid within a context. Valid being defined as useful within a context. And any theory that's even useful in one context may not be useful in another context. And so, therefore, it's actually the openness of theory or the subordination of theory to experiment, which is the hallmark of the investigative process of science, actually. When science is not being dogmatic and ideological, its hallmark achievement is the idea that further evidence, meaning further experience, further experiment, will refute some theory that you now hold as valid in terms of useful, not valid in terms of controlling all phenomena and activities in the universe, right? That's something that they aspire to because they're dogmatic-oriented people. They are not self-analytical in a deeply inner scientific way, as my student indeed was not. In swallowing that idea of no theory revision, handed to him by some scientist who says, well, Buddhists think Buddha knows everything, and therefore he already explained everything, and therefore there's no theory revision, and therefore they're not true scientists, assuming that Buddha is dogmatic in his theories, which he isn't. Because he says there is no theory that finally captures the inconceivability of reality. But that doesn't mean that the inconceivable reality cannot be experienced, because it can, and that's what a Buddha does. So I think it's so brilliant. I love it. Buddha says, I've said this before, but I'll say it again. Buddha says, wow, I know everything, and it's great, and I'm really happy. And you might find that encouraging, but I'm so sorry, because I can't really explain it to you. Or rather, I can explain a lot of things to you that can help you develop your own ability to experience more and more of this marvelous reality. But no explanation is by itself going to enable you to do it. So no explanation will capture it. It is inconceivable. It is beyond our expectations. But that it's not beyond our ability to experience it, because we are it. And it is us. We're part of that reality. And we can be a bigger and bigger part by experience. And theory is a way, in a way, closes us off from a reality. It pretends that we're outside of it and we can control it by some language, by some dogmas. And that's the mistake that we've all made and that I had been making. And when I got free of that mistake, I now have the theory of no theories. And that you can't revise. Or rather, you can. And you can open-endedly revise, but once you have the confidence that no theory that you will be the final theory. Because life goes on, you know. That's really great. And therefore, this is what I wanted to say, therefore Buddhist science would argue that materialists, dogmatic scientific materialists, have no science, because they have no theory revision, because they won't revise that theory to allow the mind to being part of nature. They consider that heresy and the crawling back into religious extremism. And they won't revise their theory, so therefore they are dogmatically extremist, and they're no longer a scientist in the sense of open to more data, open to more experience. An experiment just means experience, because you experience the results of the experiment. You got it? Even meant might have to do with mentality, mind. Your mind tries to interpret your experience. That could be. I'll look it up. Well, that's speculation at the moment, but I'll look it up in an etymological dictionary. Experiment. Meant might be related to mens, which means mind, and connect also to mensa, which means table. Very interesting. So, therefore, Buddhist science is the only science, and true experimental science is the only science. And actually, experimental science reached the Buddhist theory of no theory in Copenhagen in 1926, almost 100 years ago. Why are you guys still pretending that it's not the case? Why? The people who do follow that, you know, I have to here pay homage to Henry Stapp, the great quantum physicist. One lecture that he gave, at one of Deepak's conferences, blew my mind, and it's helped me ever since. And maybe others will want to reject it or disagree with him, but it seemed to me to make perfect sense, and nothing that I have seen yet has contradicted it. And that, including the paper I read of the person who claims to have unified gravity and electromagnetism, based on some kind of amazing thing, and still comes up with a, you know, evolutionism about mind, that it just comes from complexity of material formations and still therefore is essentially material. So I think his claim is speculative and exaggerated, but I'll try to study more. So and that is 1926, they said, when you get down to the finest level of analysis of reality with the most sophisticated and subtle machinery, you know, electron microscopes, whatever you want to call it, it's cloud chambers, you lose the objectivity of your what you're observing, because your act of observing it interferes with it. So subjectivity and objectivity mingle, and you will never be certain about whatever you measure and how you locate and how you observe things. And therefore there's no absolute objectivity, and there is no way of capturing this elusive reality at the super micro quantum level and subquantum level. But, and so we have to give up that attempt, but, or aim ourselves in a different direction from that attempt, because at a less micro level, less analytic level, we can work statistically and operationally with causal processes in such a way as to still intervene with reality in marvelous ways in specific constant contexts. And this create, and then Einstein rebelled against that and said, no, I don't give up. I'm going to, you know, God does not play dice with reality. And I'm going to find out how it works for sure. And that's what I'm doing. I don't agree with you. And then he led a whole group of physicists who theorize and who are looking through theory, thought experiments and theory and mathematical experiments, you know, like formulations and complex speculations. And they're into string theory and 11 dimensions and all sorts of things. They went in one direction. And the other ones who accepted the practical or pragmatistic philosophical result of that you cannot pin things down finally in a theory, that theories are, which is the Popperian theory of science, which is that theories are hypotheses developed to account for data, for experience in experiment, as best as possible within that context. And they're waiting falsification by more data. They're not absolute dogmas. They can never be. So that, as a principle of science's investigative openness, is the same as Buddhism's investigative openness based on the theory of no theory, Buddha's emptiness theory. His discovery of relativity. And emptiness, by the way, is not a discovery of a void or a vacuum. It's a discovery of relativity, because the vacuum is devoid of itself. And therefore, the vacuum is the space in which all relativity occurs. And voidness is that there's nothing but that relativity. That relativity is not occurring with respect to or against in a framework of any kind of absolute. And anywhere you find someone claiming to have the ultimate theory, you will look to see that they refer to the universe, the bounded universe. They're assuming it has its limits. It's a spherical this or it's that and the other, you know. And that's absurd. Of course, you know, the speed of light, something moving away from you, you get no light, so you'll never know it's there. That doesn't mean that the universe doesn't include it. It could be so far away from you that you can't see it ever, and you're never going to, but that doesn't mean it isn't there. It's because you don't see it. You know, I don't think you can't see a black hole, supposedly. But you think you're sure they're there because things fall into it, supposedly. And then pulsars blow out of it, maybe. But the whole point is the whole thing is inconceivable. Ultimately, your theories will not control it. Which doesn't mean you can't keep investigating places in it to make them better for the sensitive beings in it, especially yourself. And a full embrace of that inconceivability may well be a state of awareness that is the ideal of science, which is this kind of ultimate openness. So therefore, but in practical terms in science, what that means is Buddhist scientists can appreciate material scientists in the sense of you can, in a specific context, consider everything you're looking at as just material and analyze it down till it disappears under analysis. and you can find out a lot of things about its structure, about its causal processes, etc. And then you can intervene with them in such a way as to ameliorate their relationship to you. Like, you know, you can put out a fire that's going to burn down the planet or whatever, you know. So it's really, they love material science. We love material scientists. And Buddhists had great material scientists themselves. They had wonderful doctors, botanists, you know, all kinds of things, not just some mumbo jumbo only. And they had neuroscience, actually. How to adapt your own subtle nerves, nervous system from within your mind. Not just by putting machines and clomping headphones and electrodes on your head, you know. Actually go into your head with your own awareness. Through highly more focused awareness, you know. They developed the inner sciences and the tools of inner science, which is a focused mind, primary one, but also concepts are, you know, really well, you know. But they can really appreciate the inner science one. At the same time, there's the materialists. And then they can also appreciate in their own ranks, they have some people who you could say are extremist idealists or mentalists, or I don't know what else you'd call them, psychologists, who say everything is reducible to mind. Because when they look at material objects, they see they dissolve under analysis. And they think that when they look at mental objects, there's one mental object, which is the enlightened mind or something, which is experienceable and doesn't dissolve under analysis. So maybe that's the absolute. And they develop terms that as if it was the absolute, as if it was separate from all of its relative components. And wasn't just all the relative components. So there's some, again, because it's inconceivable, it becomes paradoxical. So the point is, with ultimate ideological flexibility, you're a true scientist. If you become dogmatic in either mentalism or materialism, you become dogmatic. If you're a decent philosopher, you realize that the meaning of the word mind and the meaning of the word matter, mass, etc., are just a pair, binary pair, and neither one has meaning without the other. For example, at the super subtle level, therefore, the Buddhists say that mind and matter are the same. There's no difference in a way. There's the super subtle level panpsychism, which there is a certain group of physicists who are moving in that direction. They are saying that atoms are conscious, subatomic particles are conscious. It's called. So therefore, you don't have to worry about where did consciousness come from because it is everything. and yet it's also all matter. And therefore, you can deal with it as matter or as mind. I guess that's where they're moving. So it's a good movement, philosophically kind of within physics. Called panpsychism. There are several people who are physicists who uphold that. And that's the kind of ballpark. That's good. That's a good direction. So either one can be useful. Neither one should imprison you in an extremist view, is the point. And that means there's endless theory of revision, except for the revision of the new theory. But theory revision is based on a kind of no theory anyway. So, you know, Popperian version. So, my dear friend John, you are refuted. Of course, so therefore, we're getting down to where maybe this is coming and where we find this. Then this relates to what I'm doing in my sunset years. I hope decades, because there's still a lot of unfinished stuff in front of me. And of course, lives. As is only said, I need three lifetimes. So somehow I need somebody's help, since I don't control my own mind that well. I need somebody's help to make sure I get reborn in a way where I can keep studying Anicel Yoga Tantra, you know, which is to me, because what I'm discovering is, you know, the shocking thing is that in the scientific treatises collection, which is I was commissioned by His Holiness and by my root teacher, Geshe Wangyal, as well, to translate in toto. And then when I complained, they said in three generations, and you just started. I was surprised to note in the scientific treatises that more than 50% are based on commentaries on the Buddha's tantric teachings. Whereas I had always assumed in my 30s and my younger age, when I was more focused on Madhyamaka and emptiness and philosophical things and psychological things, I assumed that Tantra was all about meditating and wild yoga experiences. And yet there's this huge literature. And what is that huge literature? It isn't all just like when you do a ritual, put the spoon over here or put it over there. It's not about all about that. You wouldn't have a reason to write so many books about that sort of thing. No, what it is tantric Abhidharma. Now, you Theravada, you know, basic, quote unquote, basic Buddhist fanatics, you have your sacred Abhidharma. But and you know, you consider that's one of the three baskets of sort of holy books. But you also know that that book is not written by Buddha. Buddha told the senior monks, the enlightened monks, to collect his teachings and to systematize them and make them scientific in the sense of applicable scientifically in other contexts than the ones where he originally gave the teachings, because he was a Socratic teacher who taught in relationship to particular audiences, whatever helped a particular audience to reach their own deeper experience. And so Abhidharma is the scientific literature of early Buddhism, psychological literature. Also, the ethical literature of early Buddhism, or so-called early Buddhism, I consider Tantra early Buddhism, and Mahayana, I should say, but say basic Buddhism. And the Vinaya is really life stories of the Buddha, life stories of different monks, and life stories of the behavior and bad behavior of the monks and nuns, and therefore giving rules and laws, like casuistic, you know, law precedents, you could say, to maintain comity and in the communities of the Buddhist orders. And so it's like ethics, you know. But also not the right. Buddha makes judgments in stories, but he's not just giving teaching. And so the sutra only is the one where he's giving teaching, so that you can consider that like scripture. Those are the articulations of the enlightened mind force in language, imperfect as they are. And the caveat they make themselves is that they're always going to be imperfect, but nevertheless useful. And but no one of them frozen as dogma. So they're not like scripture where it's this absolute infallibility sort of routine. Although some Buddhists put them that way, they tend to. But they're only contextually valid always, because of that's Buddha's theory of theories, you see, and of doctrines and teachings. So what we have in the Dendur is tantric Abhidharma, which means that's the science of the subtle and super subtle body-mind complexes. And Mahayana also had Abhidharma, and there were a few Mahayana early Mahayana books called Abhidharma, but they don't use the term Abhidharma because they respect foundational Buddhism or basic Buddhism, individual vehicle Buddhism, because to all beings to be free, each individual has to be free. So the basis of it is the individual's path of freedom, toward freedom. Although then the complication of universal vehicle is for that individual to be free, they have to make every being free. And then the full interpretation of the deepest, most super subtle interpretation of that is the tantric one, where at the super subtle mind level and the subtle mind level, then everyone has to be free. That's like quantum physics. It's qualium and quantum physics. And by the way, there are qualia as well as quanta. Qualia and quanta. Too bad qualia has three syllables. It makes it less catchy. It'd be nice if we call it quala. Quala and quanta. I think we should forget the ia. They put that I in there purposely to make it less powerful than quanta. So quala and quanta, qualum and quantum, that's what we should coin. So we can go super subtle on mind and super subtle on matter, either way, for whatever purpose we have. So therefore, there's this marvelous thing. Then in this marvelous thing, we get into the issue of gender. And then when I was publishing the volume one, chapters 1 through 12 of the Esoteric Community Tantra, the Guhya Samaja Tantra, with its brilliantly Pradipodyotara, or Illuminating Lamp commentary, I felt terror. Because even though Dalai Lama wants people to know what are the esoteric teachings, because they've already misunderstood the people in Western culture to think it's some obscene, violent, amoral, and unethical thing, and horrible, creepy, sorcerous, you know, wicked business, which it isn't. So the only way to really prove that is let everybody see what it is. And so that's what we're doing. But yet one feels a kind of terror because there are magical angelic beings, male and female, Dakas and Dakinis, and who are, you know, have sort of supernormal abilities. And they are supposed to watch over these esoteric teachings. And they're not to be thrown out into the marketplace, because this would create abreactions in past historical situations. But right now, there's a bad abreaction out of materialism in the communist form and the capitalist forms against life itself, much less about exoteric and esoteric spirituality. So I believe the Dalai Lama is correct in letting it all be seen for the immense, sophisticated, marvelous human development tradition, science and art that it is. And so that's what we're doing. But I still felt terror. So I was thinking how to deal with this. And then one of the things, and then also I'm publishing this a few months after the scandal and the suicide / assassination of Jeffrey Epstein and his pedophile, real pedophile ring. You know, not Pizzagate, but this is the real one. And so in that light, in the tantras, there is language in some of the texts about sexual interaction between males and females, and the youth of the female is often stressed. And so it's very scary to publish this, because people will fasten on these one or two, three, few small verses and practices of what you might call sexual yoga and say, oh, you see, they're all a bunch of filthy, horrible creeps like this guy. So then I'm looking for how it's treated in the inner sciences by the Buddhists. And what I found out there is so marvelous, and things that I had already known but hadn't known, you know, that kind of thing. For example, in basic Buddhism, you have the four immeasurable states, which are when you enter from the desire realm into the four in Buddhist cosmology, the way that the Buddhism organizes the universe, you have three realms. And you have a realm known as the desire realm, which is the one that we normally think of ourselves, and the human plane is in that. And then you have the realm known as the form realm, which is, or the material realm. But the reason it's called the desire realm is also material. And the reason that the material realm is called material is it means pure material. And why is it pure? It's pure because there's no sexual differentiation in that realm. That is to say, there's no sex, there's no lust. Ordinary lust is absent in that realm because the being's bodies are not gender differentiated. I had never realized quite what it meant that it's a pure form realm and what it meant that there's no gender differentiation, because it means that beings can have bliss experiences, like what we might call orgasmic or blissful experiences, without needing a partner, because they have male and female elements in themselves. So they have a kind of wedding of cell to cell or something like that, you could say. You know, when I'm not talking about kind of weird bodily structure necessarily, but it's a different kind of divine, because there's six divinity realms in the desire realm where the gods have gender differentiation, and therefore they're really considered pleasure realms, pleasure heavens. Totally. There's some of them who are in the bottom tier. They're fighting off some sort of demon, anti-gods, what they're called, asuras, who don't have pleasure, but therefore their only pleasure is in this kind of power fighting thing. And then they want pleasure, so they're trying to invade heaven all the time. So the lower ones have to fight them off, so they're not really quite having much time to groove as the other ones. But otherwise, they're very grooving in a sort of way thought of as beyond the human, but in the humanoid way. So what that means is that when a yogi in the human realm, in the desire realm, meditates and achieves the state of limitless love or immeasurable love, which is the first of those four states, and it parallels three of the layers of those heavens, where those Brahma-body deities, they're called Brahma-kayika devas, or Brahma body deities. So they're bodies that are gender all gender inclusive. This is not being trans in the sense of shifting from male to female or female to male. It's trans in the sense of being both female and male within one body. What that means is, they say that when you reach as a yogi, a monk yogi or a nun yogi, you reach the infinite love state or the immeasurable love state, that a cobra will not attack you, that a hungry tiger will not eat you. When they see you, they feel a vibe coming from you like as if you were their mother or something. You know, they feel such an ecstatic feeling. So that means you're in a kind of ecstasy of immeasurable love. And it just overflows from you. And I guess that's what those Brahma body deities do. They just overflow. Because they're beyond sort of the whole thing of seeking bliss that the desire realm deities are still doing. Because they feel a little bit, they could have a little more, you know, type of thing. Whereas there, they're completely satisfied in that sense. So then they just overflow and they radiate love, those deities too. But somehow they're not Buddhas. So they don't know how to kind of radiate it the way a Buddha does, more completely, to really reach into areas where beings really need love badly, like hellish almost conditions. So it's not as good as being a Buddha, in short, it's the idea in the Buddhist thing. So that was really, really revelatory for me. And therefore, compassion is when they're radiating the love and they notice that the beings are the infinite compassion, the next three states, and they notice that the beings are not open to the love in such a way that they are really freed from their suffering. So there's a little something about that. And then the immeasurable joy, it's the third one, the next three realms, up to nine there. And then that one is where then that is the irritation that the deities of that plane must feel, or the yogi in that plane, because they're feeling empathetically the irritation of other beings that they love. But those beings can't absorb that love because they're frightened of the world, so and they're shut off. So then they see, however, underneath that there's a basic joy and a bliss in the beings that is the life force of the being. So they just touch on that and they have this immeasurable joy. But in a way, that doesn't, and that's the problem with the deities, it doesn't really resolve the stress between love and compassion, where compassion is aware that other beings that you're loving, meaning wanting them to be happy, are not actually happy in themselves. And even though you see underlying, it's happiness that gives them life even, but they don't enjoy it because they convince themselves not to when they're in a culture or a condition that doesn't allow them to. So then finally you have immeasurable equanimity, which is seven of the realms, and that's where the highest Brahma realm deities dwell, in the highest level of the material realm. And that's like the event horizon of the black holes or something, you know, of the formless realm, where there's no matter, purely mental, pure energy, in other words. And then that's beyond, there's no, the bliss is all still there, but then it's just all equal, whatever. They ignore, they're in the process of kind of ignoring the way the world, the suffering in the world, and that's what makes them less than a Buddha. So I realized that. And then I realized that in the tantras, the human body is validated and evaluated as an extremely high level, because it's like a deity of the desire realm deity, pleasure realm deity, and yet it's much more vulnerable than those deities, and it goes through the death rebirth process much more frequently, and therefore it realizes it uses that kind of divine intelligence and divine sensitivity to the potential for bliss, but it does it in a sense where it copes with the problem of self and other, and it can advance therefore toward full enlightenment much more rapidly than the desire realm deity. So then it uses, and of course the way that you develop toward that is by opening up the inner nervous system. And the only thing that can describe what is going on in Tantra, it's like Reichian therapy. Wilhelm Reich is the one who gives the key to Tantra, not so much Freud. Freud also, and Jung also, because the archetype thing, Jung, Freud has the depth consciousness thing, that there's all these surging instincts, and everyone is a murderer, and everyone is a Jeffrey Epstein, polymorphously perverse, you know, at an unconscious, instinctual level, everyone has all that, which that's what freaks people out about Freud. They don't want to see that they're frightened of seeing these kind of dimensions in themselves. But Freud was good on that. Jung was good on seeing how archetype mythic things are used to channel those kind of energies in cultures. And although he didn't get to see it in tantric yogas, which is what tantric yoga is sophisticatedly doing, which Jung could be a beginning of, but as Dalai Lama says, kindergarten. But Reich was the one who realized it has to do also with the nervous system. And he came up with the theory of neuromuscular armoring, where the being, through fear of being hurt, shuts off its sensitivity to feeling pleasure, and therefore becomes locked up in a self-imprisonment, in a tormented way of life, making them then sadistic and violent and problematic to others, and especially to another who is less locked up than them, who they feel somehow stimulates in them a kind of melting feeling, and that makes them feel they're losing control, so they want to imprison them or strangle them or crucify them or hang them, you know. He has a brilliant book called The Emotional Plague and the Murder of Christ, Why People Murder the Christ Among Us, type of thing. And why men, and he didn't really, and why men, he never really got so much into that, but why men torture the women around them, because the women are less locked up than the men, because the fear of being hurt is exploited by militarism in societies. And so that's why, and which is why Tantra was esoteric in militaristic societies, and Buddhism has always existed in militaristic societies, the most demilitarized of which was initially India, certain of the Indian societies, not all of them, certain of them. There are many nations in India. And then Tibet, and then finally Mongolia. Both, which have been highly militarized conquest societies, became demilitarized. And so in all those contexts, it was kept esoteric. But now, so in a way, Wilhelm Reich, I don't know where his reincarnation is, but I hope he's a tantric yogi. I hope he was reborn back in Tibet. Maybe he came from there or from Mongolia, or I hope he gets reborn back there, or if he wants to be reborn in the West, in America or Germany or Russia, places he tried to live, he's able to study tantra and tantric science. I really hope so, because it's a real way of developing what he wanted, the true orgasm, which is not the militarized, you know, conflict-driven, you know, thrusting, pounding type of sex, you know, rapacious, rapture, rapine type of sex. It's the melting together type of sex. And it is and therefore the tantric thing in those texts is like a thing where people stay together in an artificial yogic postures with internal yogas of controlling of inner neural energies that are impossible to the ordinary person who only thinks of sex as a procreative thing, you know, and has a certain cycle and it's up and down and that's it. And this is not like that. This is suffusing the entire body with the melting process, which is what Reich argued for. He envisions, and I hope he experienced, but I don't even know if he ever fully experienced it even himself. But I mean, and there's no woman telling any tale. But he envisioned where dyads, as he called them, would lie together in a non, sweaty kind of way, and huffing and puffing sort of type of way. And then just melt into each other. And then they would be, he claimed they would be picked up and infused and swept up in a blue light, which is the blue light of the ultimate reality, perfection, wisdom, from Tantra's point of view, which is the transmutation of hatred, revulsion, anger, fear, all of those boundarying and hostility-oriented things, you know. Transmutation of that blue light, dark blue light. So that's the kind of science. And so in my introduction, anyway, coming back to the topic of today, so in my, which I've been on, in my introduction to the Tantra, I found sources by the help and the kindness and the grace of Tsongkhapa in his own writings, and he's quoting other Indian texts, in Hevajra Tantra and everyone, which equalizes the female and the male roles in that tantra, where it's no, and therefore there's no question of exploiting a female by male. In theory, in the actual real practice, as described by the real sources, which doesn't mean that there wasn't abuse, of course, in India and Tibet and so forth, where there was exploitation, of course, doesn't mean that. That things are misused, they always can be. But it means that basically the whole tradition is not a misuse, is my point. And I quoted that, and I was going to read you something from that. I've gone on too long, and so I don't want to do that. Tsongkhapa addresses how the reality, you know, it's a subsection in my introduction that's entitled the Pradipodyotana, that is to say, the illuminating lamp and other Indic sources on the equal opportunity for female and male unexcelled yoga tantra practitioners. So you can't say, if you properly understand it, you can't say that that the male, only the male form is proper, and it doesn't carry on. There is a thing in basic Buddhism where they think that only a male can be a Buddha. That's in the monastic Buddhists. They don't think the females cannot be arhats or enlightened. They acknowledge that they can as an arhat, but a Buddha, only a male. They have a thing like that. And then in the Mahayana, there are a few cases of females who are definitely Buddhas, but they're kind of exceptional, and they always are dealing with some monk who says, but dear, you're so enlightened, how come you're not in the body of a male? You know, there's incidents like that. So Tantra, therefore, that gave another reason for mainstream scholarship and intellectuals who studied Buddhism or heard something about it to think that Tantra was a big male monk exploiting female, slaves, really. They could think that. So I'll just read one verse from the Guhya Samaja. It says, the great sciences, and here science, the females are called sciences, vidyas, Lochana, and Lochana, Buddha Lochana is the name of one of the major female Buddhas in the Guhya Samaja Mandala. And Buddha Lochana literally means a Buddha eye, Buddha vision. And she's a Buddhess, Buddha goddess or a Buddhess. So the great sciences, comma, Lojana et al, the most famous one, there's a dozen of them, but the most famous ones are eight of them, more than eight, 10 of them. But anyway, Lojana et al means another nine, always immersed in the true meaning of sensual desire, do reach attainment just as they wish by seeking enjoyment of the passions. So in other words, that's just one verse. There's more graphic ones than that, but I would take more time to look at them. So that's one wonderful verse. Then there's another verse from the Hevajra Tantra, which it says, one who has the Nairatmya Yoga, that is the selflessness yoga, how can she be called, quote, just a consort, end quote? Of the two, female consort and male consort, how can there be any different consort attainment? In other words, how can only one of the partners have an attainment, the other one is just somehow like a machine or something serving them, right? Now, if you wonder, Tsongkhapa himself writes here in the commentary, and he says, now, if you wonder, what is the source for that? Just as the four joys are produced in the continuum of the father, relying on the mother, so the four joys are produced in the continuum of the mother, relying on the father. That's a question mark of a challenge. See, the four joys are, you see, the reason that it's not ordinary sexuality, the tantric orgasmic wisdom and orgasmic bliss, is that when the white essence melts down from the brain and it merges with the female fire, the blood essence, the white semen essence melts down and merges with the female blood essence at below the navel, at the base chakra, you know, the perineum chakra, which includes the genitalia. And there it encounters the fire, with the male has the red female element in their bodies also, coming from the marrow and so on. And so when it meets that, there is this kind of energy that causes the person in normal ejaculative sexuality to practically faint, and then the ejaculation diffuses that energy. And then, of course, it assists, and the white stuff goes out. And then the female also internally ejaculates the fertile essence that makes the egg receptive, and then you can have rebirth. And someone can sneak in there from the bardo, some child, would-be child. You know? And but what happens in the tantric thing is that merging happens in the single body of the male, and there's an orgasmic sensation in that lower chakra where the red and white together suffuse the lotus of the chakra. That is, it fuses all the nerves, and there's like a complete melting and an ecstasy there. And then that goes up the central channel to the ecstasy in the navel, up the central channel to the heart, up the central channel to the throat, and then finally to the brain, and then goes back down. Then there's further yogas where they go down again. So it goes up and down. And actually, the final one is in the heart, where the heart has a complete thing. So there's no procreative element. There's no emission at all. And so, this person in question is thinking, well, yeah, that happens to the male. But the female's just sort of helping it happen by getting him hepped up, you know, by getting him charged up in passion, impassioned. And then, but then they block, being yogis, the normal procreative sexual way of armored sex, or what Reich would call armored sexuality. So out of control kind of armored sexuality. And instead it goes up and down inside the body of the male. And so he's saying, well, do you mean it really goes up inside, down the body of the female also? This person asks. And then he says, I must explain this from the statement in the glorious Hevajra, which is one of the root tantra texts, about the transformative consecration of the mantra of the Vajra and the lotus, since it can be very clearly understood. As for that, the mantra of the consecration of the lotus is Om Padma Sukhadara Maharaga Sukhadada Chaturananda Bhagavishva Hum 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 Karyam Kuru Swame Swame. Actually, this is too long. I'll have to do this in another podcast, which I will do later. And because there's one other point I have to address. So, you know, but this is really proves it, that the female is a full-blown partner. And this is without the fact that like in the four formless, the four immeasurables, that the meditator gets into a kind of, without any theory of a subtle body, they get into a kind of subtle body of a form, pure form realm deity, where they sort of change their self-model of their own genitalia and their own gender. They become degendered meditatively, you could say, in subtle body form. And there's another very interesting thing about that in relation to this practice, but I won't get into that now either. But anyway, that happens. So it's not so extraordinary that there's this ability that the mind can reprogram the central nervous system in such a way as that you feel you actually have a different body. What he's saying is the female, in those mantras, the female has the same thing going on up and down her nervous system. So somehow the link up of the two central channels is as if the subtle body of a person is like a kind of oil refinery cracking tower, where there's this central channel of energy and right and left, several central channels of energy. And then there are these nerve complexes, which are the sort of five lotuses or five wheels or six wheels or seven wheels. It's all software. So it's not exactly corresponding to the vagus nerve or to this and that, although those are kind of, those are dealing with the underlying slimeware that is reprogrammed. But the programming is shifted so that this inner sensitivity completely opens up and the outer armoring is not done. And therefore, a person who can do this has developed an ability. For example, right now I move my arm. The reason I move my arm is I have a template in my brain that imagines me as having an arm. And that template is sort of stuck there automatically. And the thought to move my arm translates through that template and goes in and then motivates the muscles and the nerves, et cetera, to move the arm, okay? So the yoga of these people, they have gone in and they've changed that template. they know about that temple because they get up after they meditated for 3 weeks or whatever and walk around and go to the party or whatever they do. But so they can go back to that template, but they're not stuck in that template. They can make other templates. And so when you have the subtle body template, you have this, you're not thinking of yourself as limbs and ordinary senses necessarily, and you're this inner sensitivity register, and you move these energies up and down, and both female and male can do that. And also female can be the male imaginatively in the union, as the male can be the female in the union. And in a way, there also are more rare ones where female and male are both in one, and the male and female, there's what the Ekavira or the Vajrayogini things where you feel you're both simultaneously. So I can do that in another podcast. I will do that because it's just gotten too long. But I need to address a last point. Then you wonder, and Tsongkhapa doesn't really do that because historically he's still in the process there in a way you could say, and it's not important in that case. But what it is you have to explain then why the root texts of the tantras mostly have the main figure, the male. And they talk about you become Kala Chakra. They don't say you become Vishwamata. They say you become Guhya Samaja. They don't just say you become Sparsha Vajra. In other words, they act like the practitioner is going to be the male. And then why is that? If this became the major super subtle psychological science, spiritual and psychological science in India for the last 500 years of the free India, not subdued, in other words, by a foreign nation. If it was, then why are they all males? The main market, in other words, is males. And why didn't any women write any treatises that were published in Sanskrit at the time? And then to explain that, you have to look at the audience. And the universities, the male chauvinists still dominated patriarchal Indian society. And the kings still had armies, but they were kind of play armies in a way. They were therefore vulnerable to conquest, and they were conquered later. But they still did have them, and they still had patriarchal societies. And the nunneries had been really shut down from when India became more militarized around 500. So there weren't a major bunch of yogically educated women. There were not a huge bunch of them, except maybe in some of the lower castes, the courtesans, some of the sort of tribals. There might have been some, and a lot of the women who are in the tantric stories are like tribals or low class or courtesans or people like that. And so, but there was no big bunch of female professors, is what I'm saying. And the big university, Nalanda and others, were all males. There were no female students. So in other words, those males who had the prerequisite understanding of emptiness, the neural freedom to reconquer your autonomic and sympathetic nervous systems, to create different templates in your brain, to realize emptiness and the freedom of that, and to realize the power of your imagination and of mantra, there was not a big female audience. So they didn't have the literature to support them. Only today in the modern period is a time when we have highly educated female populations where we have to then fill this gap, And that's the reason. So there's a historical reason of why the books are still majority male, seem to be male dominant. And I just wanted to bring that point out. And then we'll come back to show the textual proof in another podcast, okay? So thank you very much. This is the exciting work we're doing, and we're doing it with the Kala Chakra, and we're doing it with Guhya Samaja primarily, but then the Demchok or the Chakra Samvara is there, Hevajra is there, Hayagriva is there, there's Tara, the different Tara versions are there. There's a tremendous, tremendous bunch of work to be done, of most amazing inner science. The highest inner science. And last point, since I started mentioning the Padma Shri, and I'm thrilled, I'm going to be developing, and I need help, with an Indian partner, who's a Buddhist monk also, but ethnically and politically, nationally Indian. We want to make a center in India, in South India, in a place where we actually have a little bit of a land grant, I believe. We want to make a translation center for these next three or four generations it will take to complete my project, what the Dalai Lama calls my project, his project, the world's project. And this goes along with Dalai Lama being son of Nalanda, but we want to create the database for there to be daughters of Nalanda more. And this is in an area of India, Andhra Pradesh, where traditionally the queens supported the siddhas and many monastic universities and things. And there may be, if we ever get around to some kind of a study of Buddhist literature, such as remains in Telugu, Tamil, Keralese, to Kannada, you know, the languages of South India, there may be more works by women, actually, because they have more known named poets, women poets, than North India and Sanskrit in South India. So we want to make this, and we need help with that. And I want you to be aware, I'm going to be on Wisdom podcast soon, and you have to pay a little something there. I've been doing these free. I want to support Tibet House here in America. So I will be having something that will recruit us. I have a pension myself. I'm not trying to make money, but I want Tibet House to get some money. So there's going to be some contribution to the nonprofit to preserve Tibetan culture of some of my future podcasts. And I want you just to be aware of all of that, okay? And try to catch the Wisdom one. I always have fun talking with the Wisdom people. And I get in a certain mood. So that's not in this set of podcasts. It's in the Wisdom Experience website podcast, okay? So I think that's it for today, okay? All the best.
The Bob Thurman Podcast is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons, no derivatives, non-commercial license. Please feel free to share, repost, and tell all your friends about this episode. Thanks for tuning in, and hope to hear from you soon. Tashi Lek.